Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel. We are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Hello, welcome everyone to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am Michael, and in the studio with me, as usual, is David. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Today, we're going to be talking about the third episode of Starfleet Academy's first season. If you are new to our podcast, you can find all of our shows, past, present, wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search From the Holodeck. All right, so this is the Starfleet Academy edition. So we're going to be talking about, as I said, the third episode. The synopsis: cadets compete to join an elite team while battling escalating pranks from a rival school. Let's see, where to start here? This episode was much better than the last one.
Yes.
It is actually a much better representation of what the show can be, what it wants to be, what it aspires to be.
That's the thing. Yes.
And with a few caveats, I'm generally okay with it if they are careful. That really is the key word, care. So yes, it's an improvement, but there's still room for more improvements. I have said before that I believe the concept of Star Trek can potentially work, you know, with any chosen genre. It does not always need to be a philosophical Cold War swashbuckling frontier Western, you know, or allegorical adventure. It doesn't need to be a post-Cold War technocratic utopianism type of show like TNG. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, with Deep Space Nine, which is a post-colonial war narrative with religious allegory and serialized tragedy. Those are all different genres. So this series can absolutely work, especially if they continue to do the type of stuff they did in this episode. And I'm of course, talking about the thematics, the undercurrent of the narrative, the foundational components, what the episode is actually about, not the superficial plot.
It's what essentially is like Star Trek at the end of the day started off as an educational show. I hear online a lot of people throwing around the YA element, and a lot of people may be confused about that. YA means young adult. Mm-hmm. It is that's the type of writing that we are seeing. It's not Harry Potter. It's not, you know, Percy Jackson and the Olympians. It's not like that. Those are examples, but YA means that the stories and elements are made for a younger audience to learn off of. And usually those stories have moral implications.
Yeah.
So putting that type of writing in Starfleet Academy makes sense.
Yeah.
Because we are dealing with a bunch of cadets learning to be Starfleet.
Yeah. And through them, it's, of course, sharing that thought with new audiences, which is largely the point of this show. At least that's what they
hope.
They hope that this show will bring in new younger faces. Now, listen, going with your thought, David, you know, and what I was saying a moment ago about Star Trek essentially being able to be lots of different things, as mm-hmm. long as you understand the core concept of Star Trek, you know, even the idea of exploration or the notion to seek out new life and new civilizations hasn't always been an overt concept. Like, yes, in the original series, overt is very direct, is explicit. Same thing with TNG. But then you have shows like Deep Space Nine or even Discovery, where it's more metaphorical. Discovery itself is a synonym for what? Exploring. So Star Trek, even when they're not explicitly seeking out new life and new civilizations, the exploratory spirit that is Star Trek is still being expressed in different ways. Now, admittedly, David, this is not my ideal genre. I'm not going to sit here and pretend I love YA narratives.
Yes.
They're usually incredibly naive.
Yes.
And yeah, they swap out intricate, complex ideas for easier, more accessible emotional nuance. But there are shows that have succeeded with emotional nuance. For example, Vampire Diaries is YA.
Oh, absolutely. As funny as it sounds.
Including its spinoff, The Originals. And those two YA series are top-notch YA.
Yeah.
Very well written. Might not be your cup of tea, but it is incredibly well written.
Yeah.
Harry Potter mostly succeeds as a YA. Again, not my thing, but the movie franchise is hugely successful.
An example of YA that I think does well that I remember watching maybe a couple of years back now. I don't know how old the series is, but Teen Wolf.
Yeah, yes, Teen the first Wolf, couple seasons of Teen Wolf were strong.
Were strong, and that is a YA series.
Yeah. Yeah, so bringing it back to the episode at hand, this episode where this is the episode where the series starts to reveal what it's actually interested in exploring.
Yes.
After two episodes of setup, an uneasy setup, this one continues its pull from galactic stakes and focuses instead on institutional values, how they're taught, how they're tested, and how, I suppose, how easily they can fracture.
Yes.
So the inclusion of the War College, I believe, is an excellent way for the series to explore very real world ideological differences that are similar in its ends, but not necessarily in its means. It seems like it could be a very interesting way, in my opinion, to create an allegory of our own times. Without shitting on any one group of people, Dave, for example, you can easily use the opposing ideologies of the Starfleet Academy and the War College as real world political binaries.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I was questioning, why are we including the War College? This is just dangerous ground. But then I thought about it. I'm like, this is an excellent way to create political debate between opposing ideologies. War versus exploration, dominance versus empathy, philosophy versus emotional reaction. Fear is what I'm talking about. The War College is broadly generated through fear. The reason why it exists is out of fear. Necessity, yes, but also fear. In order to create interesting philosophical discussions, I'm hoping this is the reason why they did, in fact, introduce the War College. And it does seem like that is the reason for it, right?
Yeah, because like I think that when we first came into Starfleet Academy, I had the broad idea that, okay, we are going, because the big question when you see the trailer is, what does it mean to be Starfleet? Okay, well, the thing I didn't really think of is like, if you want to express that question in a, I'm going to say, an easily and digestible manner for a newer audience, I'm not going to say a younger audience, but a newer audience, it is good to actually bring a parallel idea in to actually compare Starfleet to something. Hence why, just like what you said, we have the War College. Now, yeah, as a Star Trek fan, I the first time they ever mentioned the War College, I mean, people who listen to our past episodes could probably hear how excited I was, because I wanted to see the history. I wanted to see the mythos of the War College. Where did it come from? Could it be tied to Section 31? Stuff like that. After this episode, I realized I was a little over my head thinking that, because that's not what this series is there for. It just isn't.
It's a foil.
It's a foil.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a good one at that. It is.
When you actually take a step back and you actually say, okay, this is what this series is supposed to be about, you begin to realize that, okay, the last episode, episode two, was not good because the problems with it wasn't the...
It was writing.
The content.
Yeah.
It was the writing. It was the execution. Here, the execution was a bit more cleaner. It was a bit more crisper. And there was a very, very focused narrative being said here.
Yeah. Because that is the one thing that is abundantly clear now about this series, is that at the center, there is this ideological divide between Starfleet Academy and the War College. Two schools of thought, you know, and of course the War College being a byproduct of the burn, simply because Starfleet, the Federation, needed to defend itself. It needed to swap out its mission of exploration for a mission of survival and defense. So it's a great way to, again, look back. That's what Star Trek has always done. From the very conception, it looked back as a means to improve oneself and progress. So because they're doing that now here again, I appreciate this, because rather than hearkening back to our own past, eventually that's not going to work anymore. Eventually we're going to go too far into the future that's going to mess up with Star Trek canon. So there's only so much going back into reality, into our own real history, before they just can't do it anymore. In fact, I believe Akiva Goldsman said as much a couple years ago about Strange New Worlds, that there is an expiration date on how much more we can do this, going back to a real history to derive our stories. But Here with the burn, it's built in. Is now a historical canon aspect where they can use it to explore more fresh stories on progress, fear, isolation, war, peace, philosophy. Because on the surface here with this show, you have, you know, this school rivalry, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's framed in various ways, you know, games, pranks, competitions, but underneath there is that tension that's been present for decades. Is Starfleet primarily an exploratory institution guided by diplomacy and restraint, or defensive force shaped by fear, preparedness, and tactical dominance? This isn't a new question to be posed in Star Trek. Deep Space Nine posed that. TNG posed that. Discovery posed that. These are things that they continually have to work through, oftentimes, to create better, more succinct stories that much of us can relate to. And this is why the concept of the burn, as I was saying, works for me. Because now you have a point, just to bring it home, where the writers can use an allegorical foundation to write narratives that infuse Roddenberry's propensity to look back at the mistakes, scrutinize those mistakes, and make appropriate changes.
Yeah.
And that's why I do, now that I understand what they're doing with the War College, I appreciate it and I can get behind it for sure.
Yeah, same here. It's kind of like, once you actually remove your own personal biases into it, and you focus on what's the story, what's the series supposed to be about, then you can make your decisions about, is this series for me? Or, you know, is it for someone that is not in my quote unquote demographic?
And that's the other thing, you know, YA doesn't mean necessarily immature.
No. Yeah.
I mean, there are... Vampire Diaries is not immature.
You mentioned it, yeah.
You know, the originals is not immature. It's just dealing with, for the most part, adolescence.
Yeah.
And the coming of age, the issues of learning about oneself, politics, ideology, how does that factor into oneself's growth? Like, these are things that a lot of YA stories do, at least the good ones.
And I guarantee you, I understand why there's a lot of Star Trek fans. I'm not going to say all of them, but a majority of them. The reason why this doesn't fit for us is because we don't care about adolescent lessons. We don't.
Yes, you're right. And that's one reason why I was somewhat nervous, apprehensive about this series. But after this episode, you can see that, okay, there are young faces as stand-ins, but for the most part, the lessons that are being taught are legit Star Trek lessons.
Yes.
Now, interestingly, David, I asked my mom to check out this series because I got into Star Trek when I was very, very young because my mother was hugely into the original series. And she has liked pretty much all of the Berman stuff. The one series that she just can't get into is Discovery, and she's tried. So yeah. I didn't think she would even give Starfleet Academy a chance. And she watched it, and she says she was surprised she liked it. She was expecting to dislike it because she didn't really like Discovery. I was surprised. I said, really? You like this? And she's all, yeah. And I said, why? And she says, because to me, it reminds me of the original series levity. It's lighter.
Yes.
It's light like the original series was.
It's campy.
It's fun. Yes. So I can understand that. I'm not saying that she's the barometer, but and I'm not saying that she's correct, but it is interesting to see someone who's in her mid-70s who has been there since day one with Star Trek to say that she actually likes this and says it reminds her of the feeling, the vibe of the original series. She, of course, prefers, you know, the old school Star Trek, but she does say it does have that reminiscent feeling, specifically the comedy. And that's why I find it funny that some people are complaining about the comedy in this, because this is Star Trek comedy. When we have funny stuff that happens in Star Trek, this is usually how they do it.
Yes.
Star Trek 4, anyone?
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing is, like, you're looking at episode 2 that has a Mugato and a Lapling mascot. Really?
Yeah, I mean, yes. That's a little bit for me. Like I said, but it's David, funny. It is funny. It is funny. Absolutely. All right. So digging deeper, what the episode keeps circling back to is the idea that strategy without patience collapses into aggression and that leadership built on fear can't produce lasting stability. At least that's what I was able to derive from this episode. You have Captain Aki's lessons explicitly drawing on ideas from Sun Tzu about patience leading to rational thought, teachings that help in wars, learning patience to formulate a true strategy, and the empathy to understand your opponents so you can disarm them. That sounds like Picard to me. And that leading through fear alone makes that impossible. And especially the strong sentiment, not all opponents are enemies. This alone is a powerful statement for today's world we're living in.
Yeah.
Powerful statement, because many people now view political opponents as true, actual blood enemies.
Essentially, the episode is trying to teach its audience that it's okay to be on opposite sides. It's okay to be part of the War College. It's okay to be part of Starfleet. No one's better than the other. The idea at the core of everything is a search to actually find camaraderie with each other.
And seek understanding. And to compromise.
To become a team.
Yes.
Because that's essentially, a person looking at the story might see it's like, oh, it's just college versus college. No. Look at what the story is actually trying to tell, because it's focusing on this dysfunctional Starfleet team that is just getting together. They're quote unquote the first team together. So they have to learn to actually coexist.
Yeah. David, it's not nearly as sexy as dealing with two different alien species where the Federation must come in and exercise diplomacy and fix the situation. But essentially, that's what these two schools are.
Yeah.
It's a plot taken from countless other Star Trek episodes, except rather than two alien species, what are we dealing with? Two separate colleges. So I don't have a problem with what this episode was trying to do. Again, and I have to keep saying this, I'm not saying there aren't problems with the series, but this is a marked improvement over the last two episodes. This, to me, feels like proper Star Trek, even though you have some over-the-top shenanigans. But thematically and philosophically, this is doing what Star Trek does.
Don't get me wrong. With the first episode, I liked the first episode because it felt like, for me, that's the Star Trek I was hoping.
Yes, I know. Right? I agree. A blend yes,
between the two.
Yeah.
But as the series goes along, I started thinking to myself, wait a minute. This series is called Starfleet Academy. It's going to be about the school. It's going to be about what does it take to become Starfleet. What, you know, and I'm sorry, battles and violence and, you know, smash up bang bangs do not actually make for a good academy story.
Yeah.
They don't.
If you just push aside, brush aside all the noise, I mean, you get the idea that this competition becomes a testing ground for empathy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just about strength. Opponents are treated as necessary catalysts for growth rather than enemies to be eliminated. That's a strong humanist thought.
Yeah.
So for me, it absolutely does work. Now, just so it's more clear, there seems to be continual confusion about the War College, and I'm including myself. I had to do some research and read through some interviews with some of the writers that have been talking about this new inclusion. So the War College, we talked about this a bit, I believe, in our first episode, but there's more information now. So the Starfleet War College trains officers for defense and tactical combat, contrasting with Starfleet Academy's traditional focus on exploration and diplomacy, especially after the galaxy-altering burn event. I pulled this from an interview. The point of having both is to address Starfleet's dual nature as explorers and defenders, while acknowledging that the galaxy remains dangerous. So the War College handles the military defensive side, like the earlier Makos, by the way, that was introduced in Enterprise, while the Academy trains for peaceful discovery, which allows for a specialized, militarized branch to protect the Federation when threats arrive. And this ultimately reflects Starfleet's inherent contradictions, which we know there are. Peace, exploration, war, potential imperial ship, as some may call it. And Enterprise used similar methods in ways to explore a very similar sentiment. If you remember, there were episodes, I believe, starting in season 3 after the Zindi strike on Earth, where the Enterprise now included Makos. I believe they were essentially Marines that were on board the Enterprise, and they were not Starfleet officers. They were there simply as defense. And there were, I want to say, two or three very strong episodes where they debated this, where they actually discussed the ramifications and what it really means for the exploratory missions of Starfleet, or I should say the Federation at that point. No, it was Starfleet. And whether or not this is a contradiction to the very progress and growth of humanity.
Yeah. And it created that interesting dynamic where you understand is one of the times in Enterprise where I thought they were onto something really interesting.
Yeah, it showed Archer's fear, because he's the one that was 100% sold on having Makos. He was defending having the Makos there because he was, like everyone else, was traumatized by the Zindi events.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is kind of like, there has to be, always in Star Trek, there always has to be a blend. You can't be both sides.
Yeah, the political, ideological contradictions that are brought on by fear and the need to survive is not a new concept in Star Trek. And that's why I'm fine with them utilizing those exact themes for Starfleet Academy. We've seen it with Kirk. I can point to Undiscovered Country, where Kirk tells Spock, let the Klingons die.
The Klingons die. They killed my son.
Picard, when that one woman, I forgot her name now, told Picard to abandon the ship. And he said, no!
Smashed his ships.
Yeah, these are things that are constantly at odds in Star Trek, purposely. These aren't mistakes. These aren't aberrations. These are inclusions that are designed to create a type of dialectic in Star Trek.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm cool with it. The War College concerned me at first, but like I said, three episodes in, I can see what they're doing with it. And so far, if they continue using it the way they're using it, I'm okay with it. I think it works.
Yeah, because it works for their storytelling.
Yeah.
That is the biggest thing that I would say about Starfleet Academy at this point. If you're going this route, stick to your guns.
Yeah.
Just keep on writing the stories that you are. The audience will either catch up with you or they'll just let you go.
Yeah.
And that's the gamble you take with this type of storytelling and this type of writing.
Yeah. I will say though, David, and tell me if you agree with this. I do think that the War College should be dissolved by the end of the series, because that will be the ultimate way to prove your point, to show how the ideal person is not churned out through the prioritizing of defense or physical aggressive prowess, but through rational and intellectual thought in unison with the physical. That's what Starfleet has always been. So it should return. So I do feel like at the end of the series, the War College should be dissolved because the lessons have been learned. Fear has been dealt with, and now people can return to what the utopian actually promised.
I think, I don't know if it should be dissolved or, you know, that's tough. That's a tough thing to say, because like a part of me who says that I don't think something like the War College, in order for the utopia, because me and you have always talked about this, one of the things that Star Trek has emphasized, especially in series like Enterprise and DS9, is this idea that you cannot attain the utopia without that element, without the Section 31, without the War College. You cannot attain that utopia. So like, dissolve it? I would more or less say assimilate it, embrace it, let it become part of Starfleet.
I'm not against that, especially going with something that I bring up a lot on our Star Trek discussions, and that's the notion of existentialism, specifically Nietzschean existentialism, more specifically the ideas written in, I believe, his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, where it talks about the ideas of the Dionysian and the Apollonian working together, which is rationality, chaos, emotion, logic, and how together they create the perfect being. And if you look at notions of Star Trek since its conception, it's always been about duality.
Yeah.
The person who embraces the dual natures are usually the strongest, or at least perceived to be the complete or the better person. Look at Spock. And I'm sure some of this will be redundant to our Discovery listeners, but Spock is the perfect example of embracing not just rationale and logic, but also human emotion. That's why he chose not to go through with the Kalanar, because he realized that to be the Vulcan that he needs to be, he cannot be the one to purge emotion.
And that's why I think a stronger story would be this amalgamation of the Starfleet gang that we see right now, where they're learning their ropes, they're YA, you know, and everything else. But you have this assimilation of the War College where, okay, they're going to take it a little bit more seriously. They understand the stakes. They know that it's just not, I'm going to go up in space and we're all going to be happy together. No, there's work to be done. There is work to be done. And that's why I like, particularly in this episode, I like the use of Reno in it, because Reno is kind of like that. Janet Reno is turning into one of my favorite mentor characters, especially when she dealt with one Klingon. And she doesn't sugarcoat things. And I think that that's what the War College should bring into Starfleet, and why getting rid of it or dissolving it, I don't think is the right message for this series. I could see it happening, but I don't think it's actually a good message for Star Trek in general, because Star Trek in general is about two halves making one whole, you know, just like what you alluded to, Spock. Spock is a being of pure logic, but also he's human. Data, a machine that wants to be human.
And also look at his ultimate end. And the third season of Picard is perfect. It's a perfect example of this. I mean, listen, I agree with you about that. I'm just saying that it would be an interesting way to end the series if they were to bring an end to something that does seemingly appear to be a sore thumb in Star Trek. It's not that it doesn't work. I mean, look at Section 31. Section 31, in my opinion, has been very contentious for a lot of people. But when you really look at what it does for Star Trek, it's very powerful, especially at when you look at Deep Space Nine, when the recruiter, I forgot his name, from Deep Space Nine, talks to Bashir, and he says, you'll become part of Section 31. And I'm paraphrasing here, okay? When he tries to encourage him to join Section 31, and Bashir is like, no, that's something that I'm not going to do. And he says, we need people like you. And Bashir says, why? Because you know I'll stop you. And he's all, that's why we need people like you. So Section 31 may be this rogue government group organization that does things that conflict with the Federation, but by the very goodness that humanity has reached at this point in the future, they understand when they might be going in the wrong direction, and that's why they have to recruit the right people that will keep them in line.
Yes.
And that's another idea of this duality, you know, meshing together to create the best possible scenario or situation. So again, War College, Starfleet Academy works. Let's talk about something that's not working, David. But we're also going to be fair here to the Star Trek writers. The Betazoid issues, and specifically the eyes, let's talk about that. There are things that are obviously different.
Yeah.
Okay, so it seems like it's a major area of contention for some fans, this whole Betazoid thing. Now, except for the stupidity of the sign language that made no fucking sense, I'm not overly anxious about this. I'm going to wait to see what they do, because personally, outside of the silly, pointless sign language scene in the previous episode, I'm not worried about the obvious differences. We've never seen Betazoids in mass.
Yeah.
The only ongoing half Betazoid character was Troy.
Yes.
And outside of that, Betazoids have always been portrayed inconsistently as far as their abilities go, which can readily be interpreted as simply all Betazoids are not the same and have varying abilities as it pertains to telepathy or any form of psychic type abilities.
Yeah.
And this is also not new to Trek. Trek has always introduced aliens in one way or another that eventually will become permanent fixtures. And then we begin to flesh them out and we learn more about them. And we realize that we didn't know much. The Trills is a perfect example. They were presented in one way in TNG. In fact, Riker had a symbiote based on Deep Space Nine canon. He should have died when the symbiote was removed.
Yes,
he didn't.
He didn't.
The ideas of the Trills were not fully fleshed out until Deep Space Nine with Jadzia Dax. With her inclusion, they were able to really flesh out this species and helped us understand it more. And it vastly contradicts what we learned about them briefly in TNG. The same thing with the Klingons. The Klingons were more or less presented as ancient Greek honor societies or ancient Roman honor societies largely. But then moving into Deep Space Nine, they become a bunch of drunk Vikings.
Yes.
More than anything, who are more obsessed with drinking and having a good time than being honorable. I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm not saying Deep Space Nine did an injustice to the Klingons, but as the IP progresses, we flesh out the species and we learn more about them. So as it pertains to the Betazoids, I'm not going to get all up in arms yet. I'm going to wait to see what they're doing.
Yeah, because like that's the thing is like, when it comes to alien races, I get it. Some of the things might perturb a lot of Star Trek fans. Well,
we're impatient as Star Trek fans, and I understand that. We want the answers immediately.
But also, when it comes to the races, especially when you're dealing with alien races that there's not much history to them, you have to literally dig deep and actually go through and actually look at like the physical canon that we have of those races and see that basically certain races are not black and white.
No. And especially, go ahead. I'm sorry, Dave.
Well, the biggest thing that I was going to bring up was like, I know everyone is making a big deal about the Black Irish. I know that basically there's Star Trek fans. Oh my God. Why are they changing them physically?
David, how many times has the Klingon ridges changed?
Exactly. But on top of this, the black irises can be explained away rather easily. And I know.
Yes. Some have black eyes. Some don't.
Some don't. There's interspecies evolution going on in Star Trek. That is why that basically certain features on races have changed throughout the years. And I think it's actually a brilliant idea about bringing evolution into Star Trek. I've stated that since the series began. I like the idea of all the hybrid races because it makes goddamn sense.
Yeah.
And with the black irises of the Betazoids, I immediately look at them and says, are you sure that character is full-blooded, is a full-blooded Betazoid. It could be a half.
And even if it's not, David, you know, human society looks like, look at real people, blue eyes, brown eyes, green eyes.
For God's sakes.
We haven't explored Beta Z enough to really say they got it wrong. And if you go at the, or take the approach of just looking at the narratives themselves, Dave, like the Star Trek narratives themselves over the last several decades, especially looking at Next Generation. Let's just use TNG as an example. Betazoid abilities from the very beginning were treated as plot devices, dramatic tools. They were not rigorously defined as a psychic system. The writers more or less prioritize story function over internal consistency. That's why if you look at the entire swath of the Star Trek series that have had Betazoids in them, which I only think, I believe TNG, Voyager, and Starfleet Academy, Deep Space Nine had Luxwana. She had a pretty interesting story arc on again, off again with Odo.
Odo, yeah.
But that's why the Betazoid perception oscillates between full telepathy at times, reading surface thoughts, right? And then empathy, emotional states only. Then there are times where it's situational sensitivity, stronger under stress, proximity, narrative failure, just mistakes sometimes.
Yeah.
You know,
because the idea, Mike, everyone should know that there are certain things in sci-fi writing that are extremely difficult to write. Time travel is something that me and you have always talked about. Another thing is telepathy, because it's such a OP concept that you could take it anywhere. And that's the problem with it.
Yeah. one of my favorite Betazoid characters and one of my favorite random guest spots. The Betazoid from Voyager, who was I believe he was a serial killer.
He was.
Lon Sutter. He was one of my favorites because if you remember, you know, Sutter is a full Betazoid. He's not human at all. And he's not portrayed as a constant mind reader. It shows that that it's not everyday telepathic utilities is what these characters have. It's more emotional. Like even he was emotionally numb rather than hyper empathic.
Yeah.
You know, he commits murder without apparent psychic interference. So there's a lot of inconsistencies and I can dig deeper, but it would just be boring to do so. But the reason why I wanted to bring that up is because we need to be a little more patient, David. You know, and I'm speaking about ourselves because we were a little aggressive and off.
Well, because that episode was bad, Mike.
Well, yes, that episode had problems, the second episode. But I am willing to wait to see what they do with this. That's actually one of the things I'm excited about. There's not a lot that I'm super like, I'm not at the edge of my seat with this show. This isn't my favorite Star Trek setting.
No.
But one of the things I'm actually looking forward to is learning more about the Betazoid people in general. We just never have had the opportunity to really explore them. And this seems like the series where we will do so. And that's pretty fucking exciting, David, to think, you know, after 40 some years of Star Trek including or introducing a Betazoid, and we're finally going to
do it in Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, we're finally going to explore it. And I love it. I love when Star Trek shows take species that were introduced briefly in another and they use it as one of their main. Enterprise did it with the Andorians and it turned out exceptional. Good. They did it with the Vulcans. It turned out exceptional. Deep Space Nine did it with the Klingons. It turned out mostly exceptional.
Yes.
So a few funny things and things that we didn't ask for. The Janet Reno and Laura Thok ship.
Oh, my God. That is awesome.
I don't know, David. Is it? Because it's kind of a ship no one wants. How does that even work?
But that's the best thing by far, Mike. It's because no one wants it. You're going to get it. And it's because of Janet Reno that basically makes it so much better.
Like, listen, Reno's kind of cool. Like, he needs to be with like a 7 or 9. Put her with a hot chick.
But Mike, the thing is, Janet she knows where she has to aim.
What does that even mean?
Because like, I'm sorry, Thok has turned into the perfect foil for Janet Reno. Yeah.
I will say that her voice, Laura Thok, is grating. But it's supposed to be. Yes, it does work. Because if you remember I feel like the way she's playing the half Klingon, half Jem'Hadar is pretty spot on. Because it's a combination. The way she enunciates and the way her voice cuts, it is an actual combination between the forcefulness
of a Klingon,
but then the piercing gratingness
of a Jem'Hadar. Yeah.
I'm like, it's pretty fucking spot on. So I do like it. I just don't know if I'm on board this particular ship. I mean, if we were going to start shipping this early on, I mean, come on. There's so many choices.
But it works. That's the beautiful part. At first, I was like going, no, this doesn't work. I can't get behind this. But particularly in this episode, it suddenly started clicking with me, especially towards the end when they are interacting with each other. Okay. Oh, no, this makes complete sense. Because when you think of Reno's personality, where just like you said, she's grating on the inside and you have Thok who's grating on the outside. That's like perfect. It's like a perfect mesh of this character that
it's fun, right?
It's funny because it's so grating to the Starfleet Academy kids. Then I'm like going, yes, this is how they're gonna learn. Yeah, punish them. Please punish them. Because that's the thing, especially in this episode. I don't know about you, but I have nothing against like all the younger characters that we've been introduced to.
No, I'm okay with them.
I'm okay with them, but I do want them to get their butts handed to them. I really do.
Well, I will say I was triggered by what the
which part?
By the comment that the War College douches said. Do you find it difficult to run while also debating the ethical ramifications of hurting the floor? Dude, I'm like, I felt triggered. I feel like that was aimed at me.
That was aimed at me. Yes. Yes. I wanted to stand up and basically go, oh, kill them.
I'm like, first kill off, them. This sounds like a very interesting topic. Can we get into this?
Can we get into this? And secondly, I want to punch you in the face.
Now, I will say a negative. If the middle finger keeps making an appearance, soon it should just be given an actual credit during the title sequence. That's one thing. Like, flipping the bird is the most childish, pseudo-rebellious act. It's silly, and I don't know if I like that they keep having these characters do that. And I know there are people complaining about this idea of incorporating real world vernacular and real word gestures into mm-hmm. Star Trek because they say it dates the show. And I would mostly agree with that. It does date the show. Look at Star Trek 4.
Oh, yeah.
My biggest problem with Star Trek 4, it's an excellently written movie, but it doesn't really hold up. And I know I'm going to get a bunch of like hate mail now, but it doesn't hold up because it takes place in 1980 San Francisco.
Yes.
And there's real world vernacular jokes, and it feels incredibly dated when you watch it in 2026. Whereas you can pop on a 4K version of Wrath of Khan, you're like, fuck yeah, dude.
Yeah.
This still holds up. You know, so I get their complaints about the vernacular. And if I was writing this, I would also probably try to move away from it. It's the reason why successful sci-fi series like, I believe, The Expanse did it, Battlestar Galactica, they come up with their own like curse words and vernacular because it keeps them separated from real world, which then dates the show, displaces the show, and also breaks the illusion oftentimes.
This is the one problem I've always had because I've read a lot of YA books.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the things I've always said is a stereotype that I think YA writers need to stop. Is if you're writing a certain thing, just because it happens in present day doesn't mean it fits in your setting.
It's the equivalent of Luke Skywalker in The Last Jedi doing the Jay-Z maneuver and shaking the haters exactly. off.
And
that was one of the worst things they've ever put in fucking Star Wars.
Because that was like Mark Hamill doing that.
Yeah.
And here's the thing that I feel about like the middle finger in Star Trek is kind of like, if say you were to actually have it where the character of say Aki, that's a thing of hers. It makes sense because, well, she's lived 450 plus years.
Yeah.
So she still has those things. And then you can have like little moments and of character moments of the characters, like the young characters going, what the hell is she doing? But they treat it like they know what it means. And I'm like going, this is a gesture 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
It doesn't compute.
Yes. Yes. I would probably agree with that. However, I believe the flipping the bird, I'd have to do some research, but didn't it originate from ancient Roman times? Technically,
I'd have to look it up. I'm not sure.
That's what, how many years ago was that?
But still, there are other gestures that are dated, Mike. There are things that are like, when you look at it, you go, what the hell does that mean? Oh, that's what it means.
And just to be fair, because this is what we, you know, I strive to be. The same feeling I get from their chosen vernacular and, you know, culturally specific curse words, if you will, is the same feeling I got when Data said, oh, shit, in Generations.
Yes.
Was it fucking funny as hell? Yes, yes it was.
It was.
When you watch it now, it's funny as hell. But when I watched that, I was like, you get taken out. You're pulled out.
Yes, you get taken out. And yes, that is a trope that you could use as a writer to kind of punch your audience in the face. But when you're doing it constantly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't work.
I agree.
You need to moderation as a writer.
I think that's really the truth of it, right? It's okay if they speak in slang, but first off, it would be more interesting to hear. We're dealing with really one human, right?
Yeah.
Out of the group. You have Caleb. He's a human. And then we have a Klingon, a hologram, and then I forgot the species of Genesis. Why are they using human vernacular?
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Like, they should be using their own cultural bad words. Mm-hmm. That would make, especially the fact that Jaden, I believe is the Klingon's name. He's a fucking Klingon. We know Klingons have tons of bad words.
Absolutely.
And insults.
I mean, that would be so much more engrossing to see Jaden have to deal with that, especially since you're trying to push the fact that he's a pacifist.
Yeah, that's
okay.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden he should be actually using his own freaking language.
Yeah.
Where he holds back because guess what? He doesn't want to offend anybody.
I am curious about that character quite a bit.
I am too.
You're dealing with, I suppose, I don't believe he's actually called himself a pacifist, but he doesn't want to be involved in violence. So obviously that's the best way to characterize him with the little bit of information that we have. And I do find it somewhat intriguing. I see a lot of people really upset with him, yes. You know, saying that this is a beta Klingon. And I'm like, I think that's the point. This isn't a mistake. There's something to him. There's a story
that we're not
privy to yet. So let's wait for the story before we start judging it. Because I personally felt like his scenes this episode were rather good.
Oh yeah, especially with him and Reno. Because like that's the thing that I liked about that character this episode was like he poses a question that I think the character of Worf was heading towards.
Yeah. And also, let's not pretend this is the only Klingon we've ever seen like this. Worf's son, Alexander, was like this.
Worf was getting like this. He just basically became old and grumpy towards the end where he just wanted to sleep.
You know? Yeah. All right. Well, ultimately, the episode does seem like it's laying down the much needed groundwork for a broader argument about community. Excellence only means something when it doesn't come at the expense of others, and that Starfleet's ideal officer is shaped through a balance of intellectual rigor, emotional awareness, and not through aggression or warlike behavior. So while this episode wears the tone of a lighter, almost YA, or not almost, a YA inflected episode, it's doing real philosophical work.
Yeah.
It's asking whether Starfleet can recover its foundational values in a post-crisis galaxy or whether the gravitational pull of militarization will continue to reshape what it means to serve. So Star Trek, or I should say this episode did real Star Trek work.
It did.
It's not the best Star Trek episode. It has problems, but it is working itself out. It's attempting to find its feet. And the fact that we got an episode like this barely within the third episode, it does give me a little bit more hope about the season overall.
It gives me pause where episode two really made me want to consider jumping off the ship.
Yeah. Where, episode two was a struggle, Dave. It was. Because
episode two to me was like, as a person who has kind of gotten into the swing of looking at television and actually studying it, there's a term that I don't think gets used a lot nowadays.
Because, shite.
Well, not shite, but like the term jump the shark. And I don't think it's used a lot nowadays because people denote it as, well, that's an ultimate negative. No, jump the shark is basically when the series has done something that breaks itself, right? And episode two really came close to jumping that shark. And here, I think they recovered well with the episode three. I think that episode three is a bit more better. It's a bit more concise. And it gets what the ship or the it gets what the show is trying to put out there.
Yeah. My only problem, or one of my problems with what Kurtzman is doing over at Camp Star Trek, and it happened with Strange New Worlds, is where it happened, is where they're getting the jump on seasons. So, for example, Strange New Worlds has already wrapped its fifth season filming.
Yes.
And we haven't even seen season four.
Yeah, pretty much.
And the same thing is happening with Starfleet Academy. Season two, I believe, is being filmed currently. And I am not a fan, David, per se, of writers, producers, directors going to the internet and listening to them and making changes. However, there is something to be said about old school television where there were large season breaks where the writers can reflect. The writers and the producers can reflect on the general consensus, weigh the pros and cons rationally of what the fans are saying, and make appropriate changes. Because one thing they must remember is they're not making shows for themselves. They are making shows for an audience.
Yes.
And if the audience is largely saying to hell with this, they do have to make those changes. It's the reason why Star Trek Picard, after season one, became better and better. Season two was a huge improvement over season one because there was a consensus. Season three was the best because there was a consensus. They didn't start filming that until they had already heard what people were saying. And Patrick Stewart was one of the people that was advocating for a change.
Well, the thing too now, especially nowadays though, Mike, is they have to be careful though, because the other side of that argument is dangerous nowadays.
Yes, but that's why you need to have a rational, capable writing room who understands the difference between troll-like thoughts and criticism and more rational criticisms, and then make those adjustments. It does concern me. Imagine if Deep Space Nine did that, or Next Generation. We would never have gotten to the Borg. They never would have made changes. This is the reason why those shows, if you go from season one to season four, by the ending of season three, season four of old school Star Trek, the Rick Berman era and Roddenberry era, what happens largely? They find their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that has to do with the writers just finding themselves and feeling more comfortable, but also a consensus. Deep Space Nine largely included the Defiant. Why? Because people were complaining about there not being space adventures. Now in this modern era that where they're already finished with seasons before we even watch the previous, I don't know if that's a great strategy ultimately. Yeah. You know, especially with, look at how many complaints people had with Strange New World season three.
Oh yeah.
And oh, too bad. The writer's like, oh shit, what are we gonna do? Nothing. Let's just keep doing the silly nonsense episodes because people love them, right? Well, our assumption is that because we don't have actual facts because we already are done shooting everything. Yeah. All right. So this episode is a 79% for me. Dave, briefly.
I am right there with you. I'm at a 75 with it because number one, it is coming off of a really bad episode. So I feel like, you know, since this is a school type of show, they passed. they passed with this episode.
But they have a long way to go.
They have a long way to go.
To increase and improve their GPA.
You went from an F to a C. Fantastic.
Yeah. I will say, David, just to be fair to the writers, I did probably get a little toxic in the second episode discussion. And I did go back and watch. And I know you don't agree. I do not hate the second episode as much as I did. I still hate the sign language thing. That's okay. I think that's just an error at a magnitude. You know, I'm going to leave it alone. I'm not going to go
there. Don't go there because, but, you know, we could go on there for about like an hour.
But ultimately, the episode was trying to be Star Trek. It just didn't achieve it. It's not as bad as I had.
It was, let's put it this way. It was a small baby wearing, you know, a Starfleet officer's bod outfit.
You possibly might have been justified in aborting this baby, you might have been justified. But you went ahead and gave life a chance.
You gave life a chance. You kezzed it. You kezzed it.
All right, let's close out. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.